The Anchorage Assembly, the mayor, and employees in the municipal government make decisions that impact your everyday life. They affect everything from when streets are plowed, to what you pay in taxes, to how bold you can build that deck. So how exactly does the municipal government work? How does the assembly make decisions? And what's it like to serve in public office? Today on Hometown Alaska, we'll get a civics education lesson from two assembly members and take a tour of Anchorage's Municipal Election Center. I'm your host, Ann Hillman, and I'm joined in the studio today in Anchorage by assembly members Austin Quinn Davidson and Meg Zalatel. Thanks so much for being here. Before we jump into our conversation with them, I want to take you on an audio tour of the Election Center. Municipal workers are mailing ballots for this spring's elections tomorrow. Register voters in Anchorage can vote on a number of issues, from who will fill a number of vacancies on the Anchorage Assembly, to bond propositions, to amendments to the city charter. The ballot has two separate pages of items. So what happens to those ballots after they land in your mailbox? How do we keep our elections secure? Elections Administrator Jamie Hines gave me a tour of the facility. I want to note that this audio tour is considerably shortened. It takes a really long time to explain all of the different processes elections officials follow to keep your ballot safe and make sure every vote is counted correctly. There are even rules about where people can stand and when. I focused on the main points of what happens to your ballot when it arrives at the center. So now, let's journey together to a warehouse on Ship Creek in Anchorage.
My name is Jamie Hines. I am the election administrator for the municipality of Anchorage.
So we're in the election center, the municipality of Anchorage Election Center. Describe the whole room for people who've never been here before.
Sure. So it's a large warehouse, and we have storage in the east side of the building. We have locked cages where we keep undeliverable ballots. We have pallets full of empty boxes that we recycle and use in the current election for storing scanned ballots. And we have supplies for our Anchorage vote centers also stored over here.
This room is filled with lots and lots of cages. They're made out of the kind of fencing that you would see outside to keep like your dog in the yard or something, but really secure. Why are there so many of these boxes and fences?
The cages are for storing ballots. They stay in cages most of the time, and the cages are locked with padlocks. And we require that two election workers are with ballots at all times. So when ballots are unattended, they are stored in locked cages at their phase of the process so that we are ensured that they're secure at all times.
Okay. The cages are empty right now. Have ballots been mailed?
The ballots will be mailed on March 14th. When voters receive their ballots, they can return them through secure Dropbox. They can return them by mail, or they can return them to vote centers. And so starting on the 15th of March, we will start circulating and going to the drop boxes to pick up the ballots that come in. And the drop box workers work in teams of two, and then they bring the ballots back here to the sorter, which is on the west side of the building.
So describe to me the sorter.
The sorter is what we call a high-tech register. So every mailed ballot has a barcode on it, and that barcode is individual to that voter for that year. And so when the ballots come in, they come through the sorter, and the sorter is scanning that barcode and checking that person off of the voter register as having voted. It is scanning an image of their signature, and then it's also weighing the ballot to make sure that there is only one ballot inside. On one side of the sorter, there are red buckets, and those are challenges. So if the sorter finds something wrong with it, as in a previous elections ballot is coming through, or the ballot is weighing too heavy, or if a voter has voted a second time somehow, where they may have mailed in their mailed ballot, but then they went and voted in the vote center, the barcode is the same and it will kick it out as having already voted. So those kick out on one side of the sorter. Once the sorter is done with what we call first pass, the signature images are displayed on our signature verification team's computers. We have five of them, and their system is connected by a local area network to the sorter system and a server, and it is not connected to the internet. So the signature verification team is verifying signatures. We get up to 5 signatures from the State of Alaska voter registration database, and our signature verification team reviews the signatures against those. We have 2 people look at every signature, and our signature verification team is trained by forensic document examiners, and so we do know that a voter is gonna maybe get shakier over time, and so they're trained to watch for that type of thing. They're watching for specific characteristics in the signatures, so they can see a voter's signature changing over time.
So when they're looking at these signatures, where are the physical ballots at this point? Like, how do you know which physical ballot goes with that signature?
The sorter system keeps track of all of that. So the ballots go in the cage on the back wall, and the signature verification team is only looking on the signatures, and we keep it in order by batch number in buckets in the cages. So once the sorter system has given us back all of the signatures that are good, we print out a batch manifest, which is our tracking system where we track the ballots from where we've determined that the signatures are good through the scanning phase. So they get the batch manifest form on top. We tell the envelope opening team how many ballots are in this bucket. And then the buckets are moved into the a cage over here in the middle of the building where they wait for the envelope opening team to get to it to open them. I want to talk briefly about the cure process. If a signature is determined to be not good, and if there is no reference signature, or if the voter didn't sign, they are outsorted from the sorter into red buckets. The red buckets are put into the cage and managed by batch number. The sorter system kicks out a report of all of the what we call their challenged ballots, and our review and resolution team works the challenged ballot report. They, within 3 days and often the next day, send a letter to the voter notifying them of what their specific problem is, and offers the voter an opportunity to cure. And they cure by signing the letter, verifying that they voted, and providing an identifier. In the cases where there is no signature, no reference signature, the voter is asked to provide a copy of their ID. When the review and resolution team gets the letter back with the information on it to cure it, they then release those ballots back into the stream, into the batch numbers that they were working in, and they are eventually opened. Our envelope opening team sorts them out in batches of 25. If somebody gets maple syrup or grape jelly on their ballot envelope, they do sometimes stick together with the ballot next to them. And occasionally we find that in the envelope opening area. And so we find the one that didn't make it through the sorter and put it back through the stream so that we make sure that it is properly accounted for. The envelope opening team, we do have 2 slicers that will slice the envelopes open for them, and then they come back to their tables and they count again to make sure that they still have that right number of ballots in their batch, that they didn't leave it over there or lose one along the way.
Because the slicers they're not just like letter openers, that's a machine over there, so it's a little easier.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're very appreciative of those. They're very speedy at just slicing open those envelopes. So they get back to their tables, and they always work in pairs. Our ballots always have 2 people in custody of them anywhere they go. If they're not in the custody of 2 people, they are in a locked cage. So they start opening the ballots. They keep the voter's information down on with their envelopes, and they start separating the envelopes from the secrecy sleeves. And they start pulling, and they get to their 25, and they hold up the return envelopes to the light, and they see light through it, so they know that every envelope is empty. and then there's holes in them so that, and they string them. So at quick glance, when you see a strung batch of envelopes, you know that that whole batch of envelopes is empty. And we store those, because they have confidential data on them, in our vault. To on the other side of the envelope opening area and moving back towards the entrance of the building, we have our scanning, adjudication, and tabulation system. These are 5 computers and a server that are not connected to the internet. They are a local network. And the scanning team scans in the ballots. And when it's scanning, it's also imprinting a batch number on the ballot. So we can go back to ballot 68 from batch 59 from scanner number 3 and look at it and verify that it from the adjudication system. When we're adjudicating, we can find that number, and if it's a blank ballot or if we just need to look at it for some other reason, we can go back to that exact batch and that exact ballot and find that ballot and confirm what we're seeing in the adjudication system. Once they're scanned, they are put onto a cart on the other side of the tables. So scanned ballots never come back through an unscanned area, and then the cart is moved out and around into the vault area.
It seems like a really comprehensive process to make sure that nothing gets mixed up, everything's watched, everything's definitely counted, and if there's a problem, it's rectified.
Yep, it is. We have many checks and balances, and we have 2 people with the ballots at all times to make sure that everybody's ballot is counted and that it's counted properly, and that if we encounter a human error, we can figure it out and fix the problem. On election night, we pull tabulation results from this computer. We bring a thumb drive and use the thumb drive to get it out. It's not connected to the internet, so we have to use the thumb drive to get the report from the tabulation system over to our computers, which are connected to the internet. And those results are then PDF'd and uploaded to the internet. Voters are able to track their ballots through most of the system. You can sign up for ballot tracks. You can do that at anchoragevotes.com, and that will give you notifications. You can vote at home. You complete your ballot at home and submit it on or before Election Day. If you submit it by mail, it's going to be 87 cents for postage or 2 forever stamps. You can also drop off your ballot at a secure drop box. You can find the locations for the secure drop boxes at muni.org/elections/dropbox. That map shows all of the drop boxes and also bus routes near those drop boxes. Folks that want to vote at a vote center, if they didn't get a ballot mailed to them or if they just like to vote in person, those open on Monday, March 27th. They are open weekdays 9 to 6, and they also have weekend hours. The vote centers are at City Hall, Lusac Library, and the Eagle River Community Center. And I also wanted to say that this is not a ranked choice election. The state is who had their laws changed for ranked choice, and the municipality does not have ranked choice.
That was Jamie Hines, Anchorage's election administrator. We'll have links to information about what's on this spring's ballot and how to track your ballot at alaskapublic.org. And now to our live conversation with Assembly members Austin Quinn Davidson and Meg Zalatel. Thanks for being here. If you would like to ask any questions or learn more about our city's government, you can give us a call at 907-550-8433. Again, in Anchorage, it's 907-550-8433. Statewide, the number is 1-888-353-5752. We're also taking emails at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So the premise of this show is to kind of help people understand how our government works, because it affects everything. So I really do want to start with the basics. Meg, what exactly does the Anchorage Assembly do?
Yeah, thanks for that question. So the Anchorage Assembly primarily is the face of your government if you're a resident of Anchorage. We are probably the most accessible part of government. We answer constituent emails, concerns, complaints, and then Every other Tuesday, we have a meeting, and that meeting is primarily around a couple of things. One is to make sure money is appropriated and contracts are approved to keep the business of the city running. Additionally, we bring policy to hopefully better the lives of residents of Anchorage. And then finally, an interesting thing, but something we have every meeting, is we do a lot of work around alcohol and marijuana. We make sure that our city's regulatory scheme is implemented. So we kind of take it in those like three different chunks. And honestly, what you don't see every Tuesday night are the community councils we go to, which is really where we intersect with most people. I believe I have 9 every month. And that's an opportunity by neighborhood for folks to come talk with us, talk with their state legislatures, and as well as just talk with each other about issues facing their neighborhoods.
Okay. When you say you spend a lot of time on like alcohol and marijuana, is that like the portion of the meeting where you're saying who gets a license or?
It's not a lot of time. It's just every meeting. So what we do is we decide that the applicants have met the requirements to do these things. But if you ever come to one of our meetings, there's kind of 3 chunks of the meeting, and it can get a little confusing. So the first is all about appropriations and contracts for the most part. The middle is what I like to think of as the meat of the meeting, which is where we're talking about forward-looking policy and really substantive things. And then the last thing is we do this approval process of these applications.
Okay. So the assembly is doing that part. Austin, you briefly served as mayor. What's the mayor's role in all of this?
Yeah, thanks. Nice to be here, too. Thanks for inviting us. Sure. The mayor's role is primarily to execute the assembly's policy goals that are set through the annual budget that we adopt. So November of every year, well, really in October, we start considering a budget that the mayor puts forward, a draft budget. We go through the budget process, pass a budget usually in early December.
What's the budget process?
The budget process involves a number of work sessions, and the Budget and Finance Committee most recently of the Assembly has been leading that charge, bringing amendments that the Assembly views make sense based on what the draft put forward was. And then we take public comment, of course, a couple meetings, as Meg mentioned, Tuesday meetings with public comment, talking with community councils, get a lot of emails. Then we finally pass a budget. And then the mayor has the opportunity to veto that budget if he or she wishes. And then we start implementing it as of January 1.
So with the vetoes, can the mayor veto everything or just line by line? What's it look like here at the municipality?
The mayor has the opportunity to line item veto the budget, but that isn't the case with all things that the assembly passes.
Oh, okay. And so if community members are really passionate about a specific thing or want money to go towards a specific thing, do they just tell you during the meetings, or how do people advocate for that? How do people intersect with the budget?
We get a lot of communication through email. I would say that that's where we hear from most people. Like Meg said, we're also going to community councils throughout the month. But I've found that community councils are usually a pretty small subsection of the community. They tend to trend older and whiter than a lot of our other residents. And so I like to hear from community councils, but also hear from people who are contacting us directly. People also call us. They stop us in the store. Like Meg said, we're really available and more accessible part of local government. And so people, I think, really take advantage of that, like finding us at farmers markets or wherever. So, yeah, I mean, we've many times implemented changes to the budget because of feedback we get from the public. And one example I would say is the Mobile Crisis Team, which is a program we implemented. We sort of dreamed about doing a couple years ago. And then while I was acting mayor, collaborated to implement that. I think it started right when a current mayor took over.
For people who don't know what a Mobile Crisis Team is, what is that?
You want to describe it?
Yeah, sure. A Mobile Crisis Team is a behavioral health first responder response. So the way it's set up in Anchorage is it's an EMT and a clinician. And we specifically use the EMT clinician model because when a behavioral health crisis happens, there could be more than a behavioral health crisis. There could also be a healthcare issue or a substance misuse issue that would have necessitated calling for a paramedic anyway. And the idea is that instead of, right before the mobile crisis team existed, you would call 911 and APD would come. But now what we have is an appropriate response that can really get in there, problem solve, and resolve. I think it's upwards of 90% of calls right there at the person's residence or wherever the call is taking place, instead of needing to transport them to additional services, because that expertise is there.
And so creations of things like the mobile crisis team, that happens because there's money for it in the budget. It's not like you have to write a new policy or ordinance or something, or do you?
That's a really great question. Yes, it is because there's money in the budget. I think that that's the way that we express our priorities, is how we choose to spend our money. Originally, the mobile crisis team was going to be funded, we thought, through the CARES Act, because we knew people were really struggling with COVID, but we found the opportunity through the alcohol tax. And the advantage there was we could do it on a recurring basis instead of with one-time money. And that was really us expressing our priority. We didn't want to stand this up one time. We wanted this to become a part of the fabric of our emergency response.
Okay.
The great thing about that program, too, is, you know, not only is it more effective for the folks who need a response, it's better for the rest, for all residents, because it allows the police department to actually focus on crime rather than behavioral health issues, and allows trained professionals to focus on behavioral health. And if we move to 24/7 operation, which the assembly dictated that policy through funding that program, what, 9 months ago or approaching, I think it was July 1, 2022, we actually can get some reimbursement for the program through Medicaid. So it's also more cost effective than having the police do it.
We need to take a really quick break, and then we'll be back, because I actually have a couple more questions about that.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. For more information about this episode, visit us online at alaskapublic.org.
The conversations you hear on Hometown Alaska are focused on the needs and voices of Alaskans, and the generosity of Alaskans brings them to you. Join your neighbors and become a member of your public radio station today.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. We're live on air with Assemblymembers Austin Quinn Davidson, Meg Zalatal. You can join this conversation. What are your budget priorities? What do you wish you could see the Assembly doing differently? Or what do you appreciate that they're doing right now? Join us live on air at 907-550-8433. You can also reach us toll-free, 1-888-353-5752. We're taking emails. hometown@alaskapublic.org. You were saying that the city can get reimbursed through Medicaid if mobile crisis teams are 24/7.
Yes.
But they can't if they're not 24/7.
Correct. And this is a function of the Medicaid rules. Medicaid has recognized the importance of this kind of behavioral crisis response, and it works best when it's 24/7. So Medicaid has incentivized it to go 24/7. And then we could expect up to about a one-quarter cost defrayment through Medicaid reimbursement.
So then basically that would that cover a majority of the time, like the extended number of hours?
It comes closer. Mm-hmm. It's about a quarter of the total cost of the program. Mm-hmm. And I think we, you know, it still remains to be seen what the actuals would look like because we haven't seen it implemented 24/7. So it's really important that we see what the opportunity is and what the call rate is. I mean, so much is still unknown until we get 24/7. What we do know is from its 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. posture right now, calls stack up almost immediately, and sometimes there's up to an hour wait time. The mobile crisis team is really good about getting in touch with people as quickly as possible, letting them know what the wait time is. And it was so nice to hear from them the other day in a committee meeting. They said they are so honored and flattered. People will often try to wait for them. And it just goes to show the credibility and relationships they've built in the community and the reputation that precedes them in these crisis situations already.
Okay. Yeah. Two things that you said there. One, committee meetings. You all have committees. What kinds of committees do you have? Why do you have committees?
We have a number of committees. They function really differently than the state legislature, which folks might be thinking of. There, you know, I'm less familiar with that process, but I think in order to bring legislation forward, you need to get into a committee and start there. That's not how our committees work. They're more sort of advisory and an opportunity for us to discuss outside of our Tuesday meetings issues that might be going on with the assembly. So I probably won't list them all, but we have a budget and finance committee, a health policy committee that Meg and I have been really involved in over the years, a public safety committee, an audit committee, rules committee, where we discuss sort of ongoing business with the assembly. We talk about, you know, long-term issues, things we might want to change in sort of our schedule or how we hear issues or topics or interface with the public. What else do we have, Meg, that I forgot?
Enterprise and Utilities Oversight Committee,
right.
Ethics and Elections, and Housing and Homelessness.
That's a lot of mm-hmm. committees. Is that where a majority of the work and like the dealing with the nitty gritties of different policies and finances happens?
I would say yes, there and in work sessions. So leading up to our Tuesday night meetings, we have work sessions the Thursday and Friday before that, and some usually the Thursday and Friday on the off day before, you know, because they're only every other Tuesday. So we'll have topical work sessions. For instance, when we brought forward the parental leave ordinance, we had a work session on the parental leave ordinance. We invited other businesses and entities that were offering parental leave to talk with us. We had sort of a more open forum question and answer session. We don't debate in work sessions, but we have an opportunity as members to learn about something that's being proposed and to ask more in-depth questions. If we did that only on Tuesday nights, we'd never finish our meetings.
that makes sense. Is it during committees that people can give kind of more in-depth feedback on what you all are working on too?
Sometimes. We often have guests at our committees, and so we'll ask other subject matter experts or individuals who have a particular interest. Sometimes that can also be accommodated at a work session. It just depends on the topic. For example, when we took up the accessory dwelling unit ordinance recently, we had a number of community councils who wanted to be heard. So we had a work session that really focused on their concerns in that instance. That's a kind of atypical, but we try to make sure if we're hearing from groups that we get a chance to have a dialogue with them other than just on the Tuesday nights because the business is busy and fast. Also, we want to hear from groups and individuals and subject matter experts prior to the time that we take something up for debate. So if we have an amendment or some other consideration we want to bring forward, we don't really like to be doing that on the fly, on the floor. It's always much better if we have time to prepare those things in advance.
Okay. So you're going to all these meetings. How many hours are you all in meetings every week?
You know, people always ask us that, and I always say, I've never really counted, and I probably should, or maybe I shouldn't, because then I would realize our rate of pay, but no one's doing this for the money, that's for sure. I would say when I first started, which is a year or so before, maybe a little less than a year, because I was in a special election, you know, it was maybe 15, 20 hours a week. I would say now it's 30 to 35, if I had to guess, but it could be more on some weeks.
Yeah, I think that's fair. It's It's the equivalent of a full-time job, to be quite honest, because even when we're just not in meetings, we're dealing with resident emails and doing research and writing. I mean, there's lots of component parts mm-hmm. to doing this type of public service.
And all of the meetings we need to have to work on the policy. And so, you know, we might have work sessions Thursdays and Fridays, and then Tuesday night, of course, we have a usually seven-hour long meeting. We have last-minute things come up on Tuesday, or we're working on amendments, or we're trying to review things that people have laid on the table, which means last-minute introduction of something. And so those 3 days are pretty just completely full. Tuesday, I would say, you know, 15 hours sometimes days. And then Monday and Wednesday, we're often meeting with constituents, meeting with each other to try to work on policies, catching up on emails, responding to people. So, yeah, really it is. And then we go to community council meetings at night.
I'm a little bit like, how do you have time for anything else in your life? So is it during all of these meetings and like oftentimes when you get to an assembly meeting, it seems like like there's debate on the floor, but maybe you already have an idea of kind of what you want to do or how you want to vote. Are there conversations that you all have behind the scenes, like once you've gathered information or sharing information, that helps you come to any sort of consensus? Or are you all going into the meetings not knowing what others think?
So the Anchorage Assembly functions very different than the legislature. We have an Open Meetings Act rule, meaning mm-hmm. no more than 3 members can discuss something topical that could come before the body for a vote. So okay. you'll usually never see more than 3 sponsors on a bill. Debate is truly debate, and the opportunity to hear from each other on whatever it may be. Work session, though, is another opportunity to kind of see where members, because it's a publicly noticed meeting, where members might be leaning, what issues they may have with something. Mm-hmm. I think there's this perception that we come in with our minds completely made up all of the time, and I would say that's absolutely not true. I've had public testimony change my mind. I've had member debate change my mind, most notably. I was originally a no on the alcohol tax, and at the time, Assemblymember Fred Dyson changed my mind on the floor during debate, and I voted the other way. He basically said something very wise, which he is known to be very wise, which is, we can do something today or nothing. And I was like, yep, he's right.
Yeah. Why were you initially against it?
I was concerned that all of the large social issues it wanted to tackle would just not, there wouldn't be enough money. And there's never going to be enough money for a mm-hmm. lot of these large social issues. I was just concerned about the perception that we were possibly going to say, we are going to do these really great things, but then never be able to do them because $13 million, $15 million a year to tackle, you know, child abuse, sexual assault, early education, homelessness, mental health. I mean, these are really big issues, substance misuse. But Fred was right.
Yeah. And the alcohol tax has been a real saving grace for our community over the last couple of years. I mean, it's allowed us to keep emergency shelter going, especially during the pandemic. I mean, we obviously had some funding from the federal government through FEMA opportunities, but it's allowed us, you know, this year we dedicated $2 million to early education for kids in Title I schools who otherwise wouldn't have that opportunity, which is pretty incredible. We've done a lot of prevention work around programs that prevent child abuse, sexual assault, domestic violence. It's and allowed us to build and fund the mobile crisis team that we just talked about. So Meg's right. It's not solving all the problems, but it's really getting at a lot of them.
Okay. I noticed that on the ballot this spring, there's a question about the alcohol tax and money for early.
It's actually the marijuana tax.
Marijuana tax. Oh, okay. And so it would, what is?
It would take the marijuana tax revenue, which is, this could get a little complicated, but we have a tax cap, which allows us as the assembly to only tax up to that level to run and fund all of the services that the municipality provides. And so right now the marijuana tax is under that cap. It would move the tax outside of the cap, and which it's about $6 million, and then completely dedicate that money. The state legislature can't dedicate funds, but we can dedicate that money to early education. And the great thing about early education, that we know we talk about this a lot, but for every dollar you invest, you get a $7 return in reduced correction costs, reduced healthcare costs. So it's really a long-term investment in our kids, but our future as a community.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. If anybody else is a little bit confused about some of the topics we're talking about, because they are kind of complicated, call and ask us your questions. I have plenty, but I'd rather hear from you all. Join us at 907-550-8433 or statewide. It's 1-888-353-5752. I feel like this conversation keeps going back to money in one way or another. And I guess that's because you said a lot of what the assembly does is deal with the budget. How exactly does the municipality get its money?
Well, there's lots of ways. I think the one most folks are familiar with is property taxes. But in addition to property taxes, there are a number of fees that people pay to do certain things like get a building permit or something like that. We also get federal money, grants, pass-through dollars. We get quite a few state pass-through dollars, particularly in our health department for a lot of those programs. And then the enterprise and utilities that are part of our government, they actually all run self-sustaining. So the port runs through tariffs, wastewater and the water utility run through customer service fees, solid waste service similarly. So there's lots of different ways in which we get money. And then there are lots of different ways in which we can spend that money. Not all money just goes into a general pot of money to be spent. There are different rules or restrictions based on how that money comes into the municipality.
So then how do you deal with unexpected expenses? So like lawsuits against the municipality for various reasons, like how do you pay for those settlements or those lawyer fees or?
So we set a budget in November, as we mentioned earlier. Then we have an opportunity. This is sort of just like a general concept of what we can do to move money around if we need to. We have an opportunity at what we call first quarter budget revisions to look at what we've spent and brought in January, February, and March, and then sort of finalize the budget for the calendar year. We're on a calendar year budget system. So that's an opportunity. You can always bring a supplemental budget appropriation. In fact, Meg and I just are about to introduce one that would fund an extra fire department academy, because we have some attrition and we also were lucky enough to receive a grant that allows us to bring on 18 new firefighters, and we want to fund an academy so we can actually find them and get them to work, to fund APD training, which would be anti-bias, but also other types of training, professional training. And we want our department to be a professional department that continues to learn and grow. And then also to fund more money for snow removal. We know that that's been a big issue for constituents, and we see the need. We already added an additional $1.5 million last fall before Snowmageddon hit, because we saw that it was a problem, we being the assembly. So anyway, that's a supplemental budget item. So when we have unexpected costs, we can look at our budget, see what money we might have left. We're always making guesses at revenue, what revenues we're bringing in, expenses, what those expenses are going to be. And I believe we can tax. Part of the tax cap calculation includes settlements or lawsuit costs. So ultimately, you know, when you see Mayor Bronson engaging in activities that over and over again has people suing the municipality, which is happening at a rate I've never seen, that can cost taxpayers more money.
Like you'll raise our taxes, or like yep. We just won't get other services?
One or the other. But yeah. So there's a real cost to the actions he's been taking.
Okay.
Yep, it's usually a raise in your taxes. So that amount we can tax up to, lawsuit settlements come outside of the cap, meaning we just have to pay them. And of course, those expenses get passed on to the taxpayer.
And so whoever owns property or is paying rent on property will just see a potential increase in their bill.
Yes.
Okay.
And it may not be. There's about a year lag in some of that, just based on depending on when things happen. And we actually set the tax rate at the end of April. And then that's the tax rate because tax bills go out. And then we just have to deal with things the following tax year.
Okay. And is there like a pot of money that you all can?
We also have a savings account, essentially. Mm-hmm. So the municipality is in really good fiscal shape. We've made really wise decisions. I think people are sort of used to the state legislature and the ups and downs and riding the roller coaster there. That's not how the municipality functions. We're a lot more stable, a lot more long-term focused. So we have a very substantial savings account that we can dip into. For instance, we did during COVID. We needed to dip into that and use some of the money because we knew we would get reimbursed by FEMA later, but that often takes a couple years because FEMA is very slow.
Okay, so you can tap into your savings account. We are going to take one more quick break. Feel free to join us with your questions at 907-550-8433. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media. You can find Hometown Alaska on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we are back on Hometown Alaska with Assembly members, Anchorage Assembly members, Meg Zalatal and Austin Quinn Davidson. You can join us at 907-550-8433 with any of your questions. So you mentioned earlier that you all put more money into snow plowing and like clearing our local roads, but we still saw all of these problems. I know this has been hashed over multiple times, but is it just not enough employees, or can, even though the assembly sets X amount of money towards an issue, it doesn't necessarily get spent on that?
So this is a great microcosm of how the two branches of government work together. So we can appropriate funds and say, yes, please spend money, please get the roads plowed, get the snow hauled out of neighborhoods, and it is up to the administration to implement that. And what we learned was that the union, who the snow haulers and plowers work for, came to the administration in the summer and said, unless there's more money, unless there's a pay bump, we just won't get the personnel. And what we found as Snowbageddon happened was that the state found extra money to make extra pay, and the airport kept running and all of these things kept happening, and we saw Anchorage grind to a halt. And it wasn't really a more money issue at that point. It was an implementation issue. And as, at least for me as an assembly member, that can be really frustrating. We've done everything we can do and we can't implement. We can't make that happen any faster. We can ask questions, we can encourage, and we're the ones receiving the constituent emails and the frustrations. And in the end, I just talked to residents and said, you know, if your road's still not getting plowed or you have a sticky situation like a car that needs to be towed, please use us as a conduit. The departments were super responsive when we would raise those issues. So it's not about the departments not responding. It was really kind of a structural deficit in the implementation because they knew an issue was coming. They didn't address it, and it had real world consequences.
Yeah, and we're talking, I mean, people were making, what's the starting pay, $21 an hour or something. And you think in this climate, I mean, how much would that add up to for an annual pay? It's just not that much for someone who's going to be working, you know, overnight, really physical work that's hard. And so it makes sense that that's not an adequate rate of pay that will keep people around. And, you know, we're seeing a lot of people making decisions across the country, but here locally too, of do I want to work for a really low rate of pay and be away from my family? And do I want to rethink my family and, you know, what my priorities are? And the municipality is just hemorrhaging employees. I mean, it is just constant. And I think that in some part is contributing, you know, some part of the national landscape is contributing. But I also think it's just not a great place for a lot of people to work anymore based on the current leadership.
Okay. Let's go back to the role of like leadership and mayor and then city manager. So in terms of like day-to-day running of the city, is that up to the mayor to put people in place who kind of keep that going, or is the city manager do that? Like,
so the mayor makes makes a number of appointments, right? When a mayor comes in, he or she, and you know, it's usually he, gets to say, "This is my chief of staff," and your chief of staff is the primary policy person for the municipality on the administration side. So theoretically, we should liaise with the chief of staff a lot. When I was mayor, you know, my chief of staff was talking with assembly members, and so was I constantly, because that line of communication is really key to getting things across the finish line. You know, if you're a mayor, you need the assembly. If you bring forward a proposal, and most proposals involve money of some sort, or they involve a code change, you need 7 votes on the assembly to support you. And that's one of the things that this mayor just doesn't understand. I mean, he has made no effort to communicate with us, to try to collaborate with us. And the result is that he's got nothing done, because you need to collaborate. You have to collaborate. So anyway, you can appoint a chief of staff. You appoint the city manager. City manager oversees a number of departments, HR, you know, snow plowing, public works, if that. Sometimes the names of the departments change within administration, but they oversee utilities, a lot of the sort of big stuff going on. So they have a big job. That person has, I would say, arguably the biggest job at the municipality. It's a very important position. And then you have a number of other, you know, department heads who are all appointed by the mayor. Day to day, the mayor, depending on the mayor, when I was mayor, I was very involved setting policy around COVID, making decisions. You know, we closed on the municipal light and power sale while I was mayor, which had been years in the making, and the assembly had been engaged for years. But that was a huge benefit to the muni. We now get about $10 million off of our savings, basically interest off of our savings, rolling off of it because of that sale that we can incorporate into our annual budget and provide additional services for taxpayers, well, for all residents. So, you know, I was engaged in that. You're engaged in a lot of interfacing with the public. So some mayors are less involved in policy and tend to go to events and be more of a public-facing person. I think that's currently what's going on. We have a mayor who likes to go to a lot of events. I think that Kent Kohlhase, as acting muni manager, is really running the city right now. He's engaged in sort of the detailed level. So it can, I think, the muni manager is always expected to be more engaged on the details, but I think depending on who the mayor is, that person may or may not be aware of, you know, engaged on and offering opinions and advice on what's going on in the city at any given moment.
Okay. I would just add, though, that in the end, it's the mayor's leadership. It all goes back to the mayor. The mayor is responsible for his or her administration. And so while, you know, at an assembly meeting, you may hear the municipal manager answer a lot of questions, ultimately it is at, you know, at the direction of the mayor. And I think that is really important, because that responsibility lies somewhere. Just like as assembly members, our responsibility lies with each member, and then collectively we make decisions. Similarly, the mayor is the one making those decisions.
Okay. And we are going to go to the phone lines now. We have Stu on air. Stu, welcome to Hometown Alaska.
Thank you very much. Quick question. Centennial Campground, it's been in the news a lot lately. I've lived next to it for decades. I talked with past campground managers, and they say it's key to have an advertising budget for the campground, or we lose about a third of our customers. I asked the Parks and Rec numerous times to find out what the advertising budget has been for the campground, say for the last 10 years, because I'm on the community council. We're trying to decide if we want to talk about privatizing the campground to make it produce more. But nobody will get back to us. And I'm just wondering, who do you go to get an answer about something like that from the municipality, especially if you're on a community council trying to see what's going on?
Yeah, that's a great question. That applies far further than just the campground. So community councils should always rely on their assembly members to be a conduit to try to get answers to questions. So there is not a community council meeting I go to where I don't take back multiple questions to track down answers. The other thing is to email an assembly member. What we'll often do, or I will do, is I will forward your question onto the person to get the answer. We're a great catalyst for getting answers. So in East Anchorage, where that campground is located, there are currently two members, Pete Peterson and Joey Sweet. So either of them should help be able to catalyze getting those answers for you.
Yeah, so I would just send an email, Stu, to either one of us or to Pete and Joey and ask the question you raised, and they'll forward it to the department director, who's Mike Braniff, and we'll get you an answer.
Thanks. That's good advice. So is that true for any time we might have a specific question about something that's happening in the city, like we should go through assembly members instead of just straight to departments?
I think if folks know how to go to departments, I mean, like Meg said, we can act as almost a liaison, right? We don't direct departments because our job, that's the administration's job. That's mm-hmm. the mayor's job. But we know many of the department director, well, we know all of them. And that's the sort of funny thing about what's going on right now in the municipalities. We've been around for a long time. You know, I'm on my fifth year, Meg's on her fourth year. We've been around a long time. We know a lot of the people who work in the municipality, and so we can often help residents get answers, or we just know the information because we've been around so long. And that's not a long time, but compared to a mayor, assembly members are around 9 or even more years if they serve in the second seat. So yeah, we're happy to do that, but if people know the direct contact, they should feel free to just contact that person.
So we could just reach out to any department at any time.
Yeah. And, you know, if you don't get something back, or, you know, you can always circle back with your assembly member, or you can copy us on the emails. I love getting constituent questions because it may be something I hadn't thought to ask before. It's always so interesting. And then I know something new. Because our government is large and complex, and what's affecting you as a resident, I would like to know that.
Yeah. I'm kind of curious, what are some of the questions that you all get about how government works, or what do you think are things that would be really helpful for people to understand as we're trying to navigate our city government?
I mean, recently a lot of questions about snow removal, how that works, you know, why isn't my area being plowed yet? Questions like that. We get questions about the budget, you know, what are you funding, why, questions about homelessness, and, you know, what, I think there's been a real lack of clear information around homelessness, and we've made a lot of strides, but sometimes the public doesn't realize that. That's something we hear a lot about.
I guess I do have a quick question about that. So I felt like before COVID, like the main shelter was Brother Francis, and you know, Catholic Social Services was running that, and there's multiple smaller shelters. But like now the city is running a big shelter. Why that shift?
So Brother Francis Shelter was the primary shelter. It was at approximately 240 individuals. The primary lesson learned during COVID was that's too many, and that people do better if there's space and you can stay 24 hours, which was a very big paradigm shift through COVID and post-COVID.
Well, and people do better and the community does better, because what you'd see when you're packing people into a small space is then, and not letting them stay 24 hours a day, is then they're, you know, wandering around in the community, of course. Where else are you going to go? You don't have transportation necessarily, and that can be hard on neighbors.
Mm-hmm. So they currently operate at about 120, which is a great number for them. But the municipality has a duty during the winter when the temperature drops, I believe, to 45 degrees or lower to provide what's called emergency cold weather shelter. Before COVID, that used to happen at the old Beans Cafe building, but that doesn't exist anymore. And so this winter, it was recommended and the assembly approved that would happen at the Sullivan Arena, a hotel, or actually two different hotels. We've added this idea of non-congregate shelter to our set of tools. That said, we need to look forward. So it's not a scramble or a singular place moving forward, you know, for next winter. I think that the municipality has always had a small role in funding some shelter. It's just become larger because we see the numbers have increased, partly because a lot of rent stabilization has ended and a lot of informal network systems that people had, like doubling up, fell away during COVID and haven't necessarily been reestablished.
I think, too, if it's okay just to add, I think since homelessness is such a big issue in our community, both for people who are experiencing it, but for residents as well, I think it's important to remember a few things. One is that the person that you see on the street is not necessarily reflective of the average person experiencing homelessness. So I think we tend to see a lot of, middle age to a little older, maybe single men and a few women. A lot of folks experiencing homelessness are kids. They're people living in cars. They're single moms with babies. There's really a broad population. And so that's just good to keep in mind. I think people tend to make generalizations about who's experiencing homelessness that allows them to maybe be less compassionate. And so I think that's something we need to remember. The second thing is that homelessness is solvable. And as Meg likes to say, the solution to homelessness is housing. And we have been making great strides on homelessness. The COVID was a huge challenge and that got in the way, but it also made us take a fresh look at what we were doing and what made sense. This summer, we'll have 300 additional units that we've been working on over the last year or so. And when I say we, I mean the Assembly, who's been predominantly funding it, and then our private partners, Rasmussen, Widener Homes, really generous partners in the community who have made these projects happen. And now the new Anchorage Affordable Land Trust, which is holding some of these assets. So we'll have 300 additional units. Meg could tell a story of a veteran who was recently housed, who had been homeless for quite a while and was housed through these programs. So we are making strides. It's challenging because we have an administration that for 2 years has had no plan except for a massive navigation center that goes against everything experts have told us works. And there's no plan right now. And as we've described, we find funding, we set a policy, the administration executes a plan. When I was mayor, I came up with a plan. Even during COVID and everything else that was going on, MLMP sale, we bought the Golden Lion because we knew that treatment was needed. We put a plan together. We got a purchase agreement together for a shelter in Midtown, which was really needed. And they didn't go through with the plans and they have no other plan. So we are really in a holding pattern until we get better leadership. But I hope that people know that we are, despite all of that, despite the lack of leadership in the mayor's office, we are making progress. And it's through the work of the Assembly and our partners. And we are getting more housing online and really meeting people where they're at. And we are solving this problem. And as a community, we really can do that.
Thank you for sharing all of that. We are going to go very quickly to Michael from Anchorage with a quick question.
Yeah, hi, thanks. I guess the assembly members kind of just answered this, but my question is that there has been a very contentious relationship between the assembly and the mayor's administration, and there appears to be no lines of communication even open. And how much does that affect the business of the city actually getting done?
So thanks for that question. The business of the city is getting done. It's getting done, unfortunately, in a way that it takes a little bit more work with things like emergency ordinances to provide the correct amount of oversight. I will say, though, at the department level, we have great collaboration with our various partners within the administration. It is really mostly at the top level of government where there has been a lack of open and transparent communication. So the city's work is getting done, and we're not just getting it done, but we're also bringing new ideas forward.
And it's getting done, but there's some that's not. We have a really high vacancy rate, and people are just not wanting to work under this leadership. And, we, like I said, we have relationships with people, so we've heard that directly from employees who have left or want to leave. But we have, a lot, like the acting muni manager, for instance, he's worked for the municipality for years, and we know him well and collaborate with him. So there is a lot of collaboration happening, as Meg said.
Well, thank you for your question, Michael. Thank you to our guests today, Anchorage Assembly members Austin Quinn Davidson, Meg Zalatel. This is Hometown Alaska. We heard earlier from Municipal Elections Administrator Jamie Hines. Eamon Swenson's the show's producer. Chris Hyde is the audio engineer. I'm your host, Ann Hillman. You can find more resources and a recording of the show later today at alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.